Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road, and that's not going to be taken away from us.
But what I love in hurling, I love players that will never give in.
He hits it. He hits it. Wow. It's over the bar.
Hello and welcome to the RTE GAA podcast. I'm Mikey Stafford. Special edition this week, we are talking to GAA historian Mark Duncan and to Sunday Times GAA journalist Mick Foley, two men who are very well qualified to discuss the Bloody Sunday commemorations that have been this week announced by the GAA. It's not until November, but we think in November we'll be too wrapped up in previewing the Leinster football final, which is obviously always one of the highlights of the GAA calendar. So we might not have time to come back to it on the actual anniversary, which will be the 21st of November this year. So we're going to take today to do it. And why we have these two gentlemen on is that Mark is one of the people who writes important books about the GAA history, like this one. And Mick wrote a very, very, very well-regarded book about the Bloody Sunday events called The Bloody Field. And Mick is also involved in a podcast and a documentary that are coming out around this. So, gentlemen, how are we doing?
Good, Mikey. Well, good, all good, Mikey.
Good stuff. Mark, I'll go to you first. I think most people are pretty well aware of what happened on the 21st of November 1920. But for those who maybe have forgotten or aren't so au fait with Irish history, you might just give us a quick rundown on the events.
Well, I suppose this is kind of one of these kind of, it's one of those landmark dates in the War of Independence. If you look at that kind of period from 1916 to, you know, the birth of the new state under partition, this is one of those kind of moments, you know, of just extreme violence. Even in the wake of it, immediate people are referring back to 1916. This is the bloodiest day that Ireland has experienced since the 1916 rising. And there are some similarities to 1916 in that, you know, it is concentrated in Dublin. Much of the killing is concentrated in Dublin. You know, death is delivered in three installments on Bloody Sunday. On the morning, you have the attempt by the IRA to actually wipe out the intelligence service of the British authorities in Dublin. In the afternoon, in what appears to be a reprisal, the auxiliary troops, RIC, soldiers turn up at the gates of Croke Park. They go into the ground and open up indiscriminate firing upon the crowd, and 14 people are killed there. And then, in a kind of a gory denouement to the day, you have three people killed in custody in Dublin Castle that night. Two of them are IRA men, Dick McKee, Paddy Clancy, another man, Conor Clune, a Clare native, who had no involvement in politics, but who had been picked up in Dublin city centre the night before, was also killed. You know, you have to see this day, I suppose, you know, what happened in Croke Park, which is presumably what we're going to be talking about most here today. You know, you cannot understand that without understanding what happened in the morning. You cannot understand what is happening in the morning without reflecting back and just to seeing what is actually happening in Ireland itself. You know, the road from 1916-1922 is not straight. It's not simple. It's not a straightforward narrative. When you have the establishment of the Dáil in January 1919, the separatist Republicans make extraordinary advances. You know, they effectively create a shadow state. This court system. The IRA campaign begins then in rural Ireland. The RIC is forced back into the major towns and cities. About a third of barracks are shut in second half of 1919 and the beginning of 1920. Then you also have the establishment of Michael Collins's squad, the infamous or famous squad, you know, where they start targeting the intelligence officers of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, the G Division in Dublin. And what the British authorities, they really struggle how to handle this. They really do struggle how to handle this. They cannot get recruits into the RIC. So what do? They look outside. In November, they start recruiting for what become the infamous Black and Tans. You know, they arrive in Ireland in March. In July, the auxiliary force, an elite corps of ex-army officers, arrive in Ireland. And they immediately get a reputation for kind of brutality. you know, what you see is a kind of a pattern of reprisal throughout throughout large parts of the country. You know, you take Balbriggan as an example in September 1920. Two policemen are shot that morning. What happens? The auxiliaries come out. They effectively raise the town to the ground. You know, businesses are torched. Homes are demolished, and two men are butchered in the town. By November 19, but you know, a few weeks before Bloody Sunday, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, gives a speech in the House of in Guildhall in London, where he says, "We have murder by the throat in Ireland." You know, the momentum has swung back to the British authorities. You know, Tom Barry down in Cork, who Rory be, you know, familiar with the history of what happened down there. You know, Kilmichael happens a week after Bloody Sunday, but I mean, Tom Barry would make the point, you know, that not a shot had been fired in anger by the IRA in months prior to that. In Dublin, you know, there's very little activity by the Dublin Brigade of the IRA morning. So what happened on Bloody Sunday morning was an attempt to maybe kind of to arrest that momentum swing about them, to regain the initiative, and also just to target those intelligence officers. Now, initially about 60 people had been targeted for killing that morning. I mean, Bloody Sunday morning is an exercise in coordinated killing. It is brutal. It is intimate. When you start looking at the accounts in the newspapers by some of the survivors, you know, this is hard stuff. It's hard stuff to read. And not everybody targeted was the cream of British intelligence service. At least two of them were civilians. Others were just rank and file military. So that sets the scene of what happens that afternoon, afternoon in Crow Park, you know?
So on that scene, Mick, it's interesting to read in your book that, you know, the history of this has all been kind of, it's like a tall tale, you know, by the time it's the, anyone who was alive at the time is long gone, this game between Tipperary and Dublin has been raised to the level of All-Ireland final. It was a challenge match. So I'm always interested in, you know, the 12,000-15,000 people who are at this game. Would all the talk on the way to the game have been about what the squad had done that morning? Like, is that how, did news travel that fast in 1920s Ireland? And then the other question is, not everybody would have had the same opinion on what happened that morning as well. There's this idea that you can't take the Black and Tans opinion that, well, let's go to Crow Park because everyone there is implicated in some way in this. Like, this is not an amorphous blob of humanity that went to Crow Park. And first of all, would everybody at that stage have known?
The news would have started to get out, Mikey, probably during mid-morning. So, I mean, by the time people were getting trams into town and stuff like that. Frank Burke, for example, you know, the Dublin footballer who played on the day, was on a tram going in from Rathfarnham's side, going across the city. And it was he remembers people on the tram talking about it. You would have seen on the newspaper kind of sandwich boards, there would have been kind of the preliminary reports of, you know, killings in Dublin and so on. Down below at Dublin Castle, which was the administrative hub of British rule in Ireland, the symbol of British rule in Ireland, I suppose, for whatever, 800-odd years. People, anybody with a connection to the civil service, families that were connected to the civil service, anyone with a connection to the British administration, were thronging Dublin Castle, trying to get in, because they thought the IRA were going to do them all in. So when Dublin Castle itself was full of people, they shut the steel gates, and then they used some of the hotels in the area around what's the Parliament Street, Dame Street there, to put people in to just calm them down, keep them safe. So yeah, word had gotten out up at Crow Park itself. There was discussions. There was a game. The first game that was on that day was between Dunleary Commercials and Aaron's Hope, which Aaron's Hope is DCU, still is a teacher training college, and Dunleary Commercials would be kind of, if you thought of them now, they'd probably be cooler. Or something along those lines, I would think. So they were playing in an intermediate football final replay, a Dublin County final. So while that game was going on, Luke O'Toole, who was the General Secretary of the GA, was actually approached by three IRA men outside with news that there was some kind of a force coming to Croke Park that afternoon. They had heard from a Dublin Metropolitan Police source that something was coming. They didn't know what, but they knew something was coming. And they were saying to O'Toole, listen,
you got to think about calling this off. You know, we can't tell you what's coming, but something's coming. And as Mark mentioned there, at this stage in the War of Independence, people, certainly in rural Ireland and probably in Dublin as well, were attuned to the idea of atrocity and reprisal, certainly after Balbriggan, you know, that whoever committed the first act, there was going to be a response from the other side. So everybody, again, that was also the conversation was, well, that's happened. Now what's going to happen next? We know something's going to happen. It's only a question of where. But really, in their deepest hearts of hearts, I don't think anybody going to Croke Park, and indeed, Luke O'Toole would possibly have imagined what did actually transpire to happen in Croke Park. So when they got that information, for example, from the IRA, they were torn because they didn't, they were almost as worried about getting that amount of people out of the ground. They thought that would cause more of a panic than police trucks arriving because people were used to seeing black and tans and auxiliaries, you know, driving around intimidating people. They thought it would cause more of a problem getting people out. So they kind of, and also there was this whole other aspect of the GA not wanting to be seen to be reacting to an act of political violence in the morning, regardless of whatever intertwinement there might have been between the independence movement and the GA. They wanted to be seen. We're staging a game. We're playing our games. We're driving on. That's how they wanted to be seen. So in the heel of the hunt, they decided to close the turnstiles at that point. They weren't going to call off the game, but they were going to try to limit the crowd. But that didn't work either because crowds were gathering outside the turnstiles and no one knew why the turnstiles were closed. So it was actually getting very ugly outside the ground. So one of the IRA men remembers walking up past, he would have been up on Clonliffe Road, so he would have seen the turnstile operator sort of throwing his hands up in the air like this and just flicking the gate open again, and people started going through. And it's like all the way down, all the turnstiles open and people went in. So in that moment, the game was certainly on. To your other question, just about the makeup of the crowd and the kind of people who would have been there, I think this is one of the things that connects Bloody Sunday in 1920 to 2020. The very same way as you go to a match now and you'll meet such a broad church of people at the game. It was the very same back in 1920. I mean, the among the 14 people alone who died, I mean, you had men, you had a woman, you had three children, you had people from Dublin, Limerick, Wexford, all killed. People came from all around to see that match because, as you say, it was a challenge game. Dublin Tipperary that time, Dublin then were kind of, they weren't as great as Dublin are now, but they would have been kind of Dublin in the noughties, if you know what I mean. They would have been very, very close and fancy to win All-Ireland any year. And Tipperary, when I try and explain it even to myself, they remind me of like Armagh or Donegal. They just came with a great group of players and they were strong and physical and forceful and organised enough that they could be considered to be serious contenders for an All-Ireland. So it was a big game in that regard. But I mean, even looking into the detail of it, there was a guy, for example, a good example would be, there was a guy, Patrick O'Dowd, who died. And he was climbing a wall, kind of where would now would be running across the back of the Cusack stand. Back that time, it was a bank with a 7-foot wall across the back and a 20-foot drop down the other side into the old Belvedere sports grounds. Now, Patrick O'Dowd, when the shooting started, Patrick O'Dowd climbed up onto the wall. But instead of dropping down immediately onto the 20-foot other side, he stopped and he started pulling people over. And we'll never know how many people he saved. But we do know from the newspaper reports the following day and eyewitness accounts that the last person he pulled over was a soldier. It was a serviceman who was off duty, presumably, and at the match. So that, and he pulled that man over. And in the next movement, Patrick O'Dowd was shot and he actually landed on that man. So in that moment alone, it gives you an idea of the kind of people who were at it. Michael Feary, who died over on the Canal Bridge side, he was an ex-British Army serviceman, 2 tours of duty in World War I, actually died wearing his army fatigues that day. You had people from across the spectrum. Now, you had IRA men there as well, and there was some men from the morning. Johnny MacDonald, the Dublin goalkeeper, who was up at Mount Street as part of one of the operations, was playing. Tom Ryan, who was killed on the day, was also involved in an operation that didn't work out. You had other guys who would have been involved in operations, were in the crowd. They were told not to go, but they went anyway. So you had this vast, sort of cross-section of Irish life. You had, I wouldn't say wealthy people, but people from, middle-class backgrounds all the way down to people from the tenements, kids, William Robinson, who came up and climbed up a tree so he could get a better view, kind of thing, up from Little Britain Street in the Arm and slums. It was like now, you could meet anybody at it. So you're right. I mean, there would have been people there who would have thought this was a great thing to happen. There would have been people there who had no interest whatsoever in what had happened in the morning. They were just up for a match. And people somewhere in the middle who were just worried about what was going to happen next.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's worth picking up on just that point of it. The GAA getting, you know, warning in advance, because they actually got two warnings. Dublin Fire Brigade about an hour before the game had approached the Croke Park authorities, and then subsequent to that, you had the Dublin Brigade of the IRA, Sean Russell among them, you know, urging that the game be cancelled. Mick has outlined, you know, the reasons why the GAA didn't do it. I think it was a mixture of concern for how they actually could safely exit that number of people from the ground. If you make an announcement that the game is about to be cancelled, or if there is, I mean, Luke O'Toole says this, you know, the fear about a stampede as people leave the ground. Would people come looking for the money and have to come back through the turnstiles? Would that create difficulties? There is that concern also that, you know, they would be implicating themselves in the morning's atrocities by cancelling the game. But there's also a bit of complacency too. I mean, Jack Scholdice, who was the Secretary of the Leinster Council at the time, he was the principal organiser of the event. I mean, many years later, he recalled, you know, they anticipated a raid. They never anticipated such a bloody raid. You know, they certainly didn't envisage what was ultimately visited upon them, you know, at that time. So it's worth you know, just bearing that in mind. And of course, you know, they didn't have to wait long. So the game was only 10 minutes on before, you know, the troops arrived, before the auxiliaries, before the RAC, before the soldiers start pulling up outside Croke Park.
What was the immediate?
Could I ask a quick question there, lads? Just given the fact that they chose Croke Park as a means by which to exact revenge for what had happened that morning, how can you give us a sense how indelibly linked the GAA were with the nationalist movement and the independence movement? I know, look, there's always been a nationalist ideology within the Gaelic Athletic Association from its inception. But the sort of political ideologies that maybe would have been there in the early days of the GAA, I think they've tried to divorce themselves somewhat from that, we'll say, over the last 20, 30, 40 years, where, you know, different referendum, you know, you're giving warnings in advance, don't get involved, let's stay a party, apolitical, etc. So how enmeshed were the GAA back then? And what was the reaction, we'll say, in Dublin? Because given Dublin, generally speaking, would have been considered maybe less of a GAA stronghold, like you often heard the expression bog ball, etc., and it was kind of something that the Colchis did. So what was the reaction to what happened then within Dublin afterwards? Like, was there outrage? It wouldn't have been 1916 and the execution of 1916 leaders outrage, but was there a sense of outrage at what happened?
There was, in terms of the reaction in Dublin afterwards, it was traumatic, I think. I think it was kind of shock. And I think that's probably evident in the GAA response ever since, to be honest, which, you know, on a kind of a side issue. I think we go back to this idea that, Croke Park is a place, you know, that could well be targeted by the Black and Tans for a visit on that afternoon, all things considered. But at the same time, and again, no more than now, when you go to Croke Park now, you're generally okay. I mean, the worst thing that's going to happen to you in Croke Park most of the time is your team's going to lose. And that would have been the outlook of people going then. You go for a day out. It was a release from the workaday, you know. For most people, it wasn't a form of political self-expression. For some people, it would have been, but not for all of them. So they're going to Croke Park on that basis, same as now. I mean, for most of us, we're just going to watch a game. So the idea that 14 people are killed in a place that is essentially a sporting theatre, I think leaves, it just amplifies the shock and the trauma and the disbelief and the numbness around the whole thing. Like, if you consider the scene the following day, Like Luke O'Toole is, and Luke O'Toole, by the way, lives in a house that is pretty much connected into Croke Park. Like that time, you had the canal bridge that's there now. You had a little laneway just by the canal bridge going down to a set of turnstiles. But you could see straight into the ground from the canal bridge. I mean, in your head, you have to drop all the stands that we see now. So beside those turnstiles then, there was Luke O'Toole's house. And then there was kind of the bits of a stand and a pavilion. And Hill 16 was a kind of a, well, where Hill 16 is now, it was flat with a mound in the corner. And then you had the bank along with a 7-foot high wall where the Cusack is. And then the canal goal was, again, a kind of a bank and a bit of a wall along the back. So he's living right in Croke Park. So he gets up the following day and a journalist from the Freeman's Journal calls over and he walks him around. And I mean, and I'm aware you're asking about Dublin, but this is the kind of like sort of processes that Luke O'Toole has gone through, which I think kind of reflects how people would have felt about it in Dublin. He's just walking around going, and over there in the railway wall, you can see the marks where the bullets went. And here are people that we've employed to pick up oranges and apples that the basket sellers dropped, and the musical instruments that the band dropped, and hats and coats and umbrellas. But here are other people that we have here as well with small baskets and damp rags soaking up blood off the ground. And we're picking out shards of bone from the field. And over there is where Michael Hogan fell. And over there, there's a group of people, and those people are singing a rosary around the place where he fell. And now come with me across the road and we'll meet, or come up to the, and we'll meet my next door neighbor, who will tell you a story of a man falling through her yard and being put up against a wall by a black and tan and threatened with shooting. And now come across the road with me here to Fitzroy Avenue, where all of us, whether we know it or not, have walked down through to get to Croke Park at some stage or other. Come across to number 15 where the Scots are living and let John William Scott's father tell you about how he found his son's body and how he found out that his son died when the lady who took his son into her house after he was shot kept his glasses and tie pin to give to his dad when he went came to find his son's body. His son had been taken away to the hospital at that stage. My point is that he's going through these processes. He's telling the reporters these things. The eyewitness accounts are vivid and they're stark and they're raw in a way that, to me anyway, suggests that people are just kind of trying to get stuff out of themselves. They can't even believe this has happened.
Numbness.
So I think that was probably complete numbness.
Absolutely. It's such a shocking event. And Dublin Castle authorities know it's a shocking event because they move so quickly to try and control a narrative around what actually happened.
You know, interesting in itself, the way they do that, Mark. Sorry,
it's go really on. Interesting. Yeah, so like within a day, you know, they're pointing the finger of blame away from themselves and actually towards the crowd, towards the spectators in the ground, as if they had somehow provoked the action. They alleged that actually the firing had come from the crowd. Actually, the first time they said the firing had come outside, their first account, it had come from outside the ground as a kind of a warning shot to the people inside of it. In their second account, it was that the firing had come from spectators within the crowd when the troops had moved in. They also put out the line, of course, that when actually they stopped and searched spectators on the way out of the ground, they actually found a number of guns. None of this is borne out by any of the eyewitness testimony. None of it is actually borne out. It's really interesting to look at the press reaction, you know, and again, they're handling quite a bit because they're dealing with the events of the morning and the evening, you know. In the Houses of Parliament, at Westminster, much of the focus, and in much of the unionist press, the focus is actually on the events of the morning. It's not on the afternoon. In a lot of the nationalist press, the focus shifts to the events of the afternoon. And like I said, Freeman's Journal likens it to an Irish Amritsar, which is a nod to another imperial atrocity, which occurred in India the previous year, the previous April 1919, when over 400 people had been killed when troops opened fire on innocent civilians. And in some respect, they'd actually been anticipating something like that. If you look through, say, a Republican journal like the Irish Bulletin, these references to Amritsar for months in advance, as if, you know, this is actually, this is something that is going to happen. If this type of reprisal, these type of reprisals continue unchecked, this is just the type of event that you're actually going to that you're going to find, you know. Yeah. To return to the other point, Roy, that you're making, just about that kind of overlap in membership, Jack Scholdeis, who I mentioned earlier, always regarded the GAA as the ideal recruiting ground for the Irish Republican Brotherhood and later the Volunteers, come IRA. If it was, it didn't really serve its purpose. Most of what we know about the membership of, I suppose, the composition, I'm talking about the socioeconomic composition of likes of the IRA or the GAA, you would have imagined a far greater overlap than you actually see. The late historian Peter Hart estimated that less than 1% of IRA membership was made up by GAA members. But you can, I mean, there's no difficulty finding people who are associated with it. I mean, Scholdeis is one. There's two of the Tipperary players. We all know about Michael Ogden and Tommy Ryan. Being the other one, he had served time in 3 months in Waterford jail the previous year. He was picked up after the Zolhae Beg ambush in January 1919. When he got out in April, he actually went straight to training with the Tipperary team in Dungarvan. The Tipperary footballers were trained in Dungarvan because Tipperary was still under martial law at the time, you know. So you get overlaps, but that's still two players out of a panel. It probably reflects, you know, where, you know.
Mark, would there just, because they're young, fit men who would be members there, would there be cricket players? Would there be tennis players? Like, you know, like, would GA players have been exclusively the young athletes who would have been in the GA? Or could you find examples of, you know, young sportsmen from even, shall we call them, garrison games who would have been involved in the IRA? You know what I mean?
Well, you do. I mean, you have people like Oscar Traynor, obviously, who's associated with soccer, you know? And this is where kind of Bloody Sunday impacts in the long term, you know. It stitches the GAA into a narrative of national sacrifice during the War of Independence. There's an extraordinary exchange in the early 1930s, you know, in Waterford, you know, where a county board official, you know, refers to the fact, you know, that the Black and Tans knew friend from foe, and, you know, when they went looking for trouble, they didn't find it in Dalymount Park or Lansdowne Road or Shelburne. You know, they found it in Croke Park, you know, clearly, you know, and an awful lot of the early histories, much of them are actually written by GAA journalists, early histories, you know, again, promote this idea of a kind of a seamless association between the GAA and separatist politics. It's not that straightforward. You know, if you look back at 1916, you know, even though, you know, out of 1500 people that came out in Easter week, 300 of them were members of the GAA. Now that is actually a significant proportion, but it does tell you actually that to be a member of the GAA means you're more likely not to have been involved in the Easter Rising than to actually be involved in the Rising. And I'm just talking about Dublin clubs, because when you look at the composition of them, there's actually a very small number of clubs that actually were associated with the event. Throughout all this period, you know, if you look at any event for which the GAA bears organizational responsibility, it's Gaelic Sunday in 1918, you know, and the GAA was not one of the organizations which the authorities would have prescribed. They brought in a ban on public assemblies. The impact of the ban on public assemblies was, you know, you couldn't organize your game. So it was an act of defiance to authority.
Mark, that's a bit like COVID.
Well, so well, absolutely.
We can't organise games.
It's a ban on public assemblies, and you would think by some of the analysis that the GAA has been targeted. You know,
here we are 100 years later. There's more than one anniversary on the go.
Never mind trying to have a meal. You know.
Yeah, very few things happen for the first time anymore, you know.
That's true.
So Mick, to that point then, how, not to be crass about it, but did the GAA in some way exploit this atrocity after the event?
Again, I don't think it's black and white. You would have had an isolated instance like Mark mentioned there in Waterford, is the one that always sticks out to me. where there's a very direct link made between blood sacrifice and the GAA and, you know, the almost the consecration of the GAA and Croke Park by the spilling of blood there in 1920 and all this kind of stuff. It's sporting nationalist exceptionalism that it's picked up as a political crutch here and there down the years. Certainly more so than actually going back and looking at the, trying to understand the emotional impact and how that actually impacted on the GAA. Like, I think once after Bloody Sunday occurred, there was really very, very little reference to it in official GAA records in terms of meetings, central council minutes and so on and so forth. They kind of, to me, it's almost like they're not able to process it. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. You know, it's almost like a kind of form of post-traumatic stress, I would say. And it's a kind of post-traumatic stress that goes on for decades. That over the years, it's almost like they put up a barrier between themselves and Bloody Sunday by using it as a political crutch. They don't, like, the connections with the families kind of disappears, apart from Michael Hogan, the player who's killed. There's an annual game between Dublin and Tip every year up until the early 70s. There's a name in the Hogan stand in 1926. And sort of Michael Hogan himself becomes, I suppose, the one and only image that we really have of Bloody Sunday. The other victims are kind of forgotten, and the families are forgotten. And that has its own impact too. Like, it's like anything. It's like dropping a stone into water, it ripples. And what happened on Bloody Sunday, and I noticed from, particularly in the last 5 or 6 years, meeting families and listening to their stories about their relatives back the years, that, you know, losing one person on that day had an impact on an awful lot of families up the years. It seeped out in different ways. Like, we're looking at this now with a 21st century mind. You know, in the 20th century, in 1920, it was kind of like, we just need to move on. We have to try and pull ourselves together and move on. And from the GAA perspective, the impact, I personally don't think that the GAA were in a mind, they weren't in a mind space or in a position really to actually properly process what happened in Bloody Sunday until the last 20 odd years.
And how has that relationship changed? So Mick and Mark, like, I mean, I think that's interesting. So you're saying the last 20 years is there sort of a maturity around how to commemorate it and the relationship with the event? How has that evolved? And to the stage of what we're seeing now, which I think everything has been done in a really classy, very respectful manner. But how did that sort of process evolve over that time?
I'll pass this to Mark in a minute, but just the one thing I wanted to say about sort of why the last 20 years, why I'm saying the last 20 years, is because I think between things like, you know, the situation in the north, I think settling, like the peace process, I think the changing of Rule 21, Rule 42, the whole shift of the GAA as an entire entity from being this organization that up north by one community was seen as the IRA at play. Yeah.
Which is still a moniker now, that's thrown at
it is, up there. It absolutely is. All you have to do is look at the East Belfast experience to some degree, yep, in the last couple of months. But I think as a whole, the GAA now occupies a space in communities that's very different. It is now shaping itself as a games-based organization. So when you do that, and I know it was always a games-based organization primarily, but really now they can almost step aside from the politics that they may have been obliged to be very aware of and to observe and to observe the sensitivities around that. They can look back now at things that happened and go, okay, well, how do we process this? So for example, with the Bloody Sunday families, there was no contact there really for donkeys years. But now in the last 4 or 5 years, there's the kind of contact that has helped to kind of, I think it's helped some of the families, they can speak for themselves, but I would imagine it has helped some of the families in terms of processing what happened to their relatives. And when I say this, I mean, I'm not talking about, I mean, the families obviously didn't know Patrick O'Dowd, for example, but the family of Patrick O'Dowd would have known Patrick O'Dowd's sister or aunt or some or whatever, or cousin who would have been their aunt. So they would have talked to that person all the way up the years about Patrick O'Dowd, and they would have got that sense of grief off that person who knew Patrick. So for a lot of them, that's where the peace comes. And from the GA point of view, I think being able to engage, you know, with, you know, there was eight unmarked graves, being able to engage with those families, putting up graves for those people, reconnect with the families, it gives them the opportunity just to look again at how they handled Bloody Sunday and how they might be able to do it, how they can change that relationship from here on.
Yeah, just to pick up on that, I mean, I agree broadly with that. I think what the GA has done in the last 30, 40 years is actually redefine itself. And it's not, I don't actually think it's a games-based organisation. I think they see themselves as a community-based organisation. Sorry. And you could argue it was always that, but actually what's happened in the last 25 years is actually GAA clubs hold a much more accurate mirror to our communities in all their diversities. And I'm the big change there, I think, is actually the approach to underage. We're bringing people in at a very, very young age. Our societies have changed, our communities are much more diverse, and we've tried to provide welcoming places for them. In tandem with that, I think the GAA has moved towards being less prescriptive in its idea of Irishness, which I think is really important. Now, in saying that, you start looking at the rule book, and there are elements of that which utterly jar with other things that the GAA is actually doing, and a position that it looks to hold in our society. Mick's point about the North is absolutely critical. If you look at the debates for 50 years after partition and independence, one of the kind of running sores in the GAA is the debate about the ban on foreign games that is abolished at the beginning of the 1970s. But that doesn't park the politics in any sense of way, because it coincides with the onset of the Troubles. And in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, there are extraordinary debates going on internally of the GAA about what approach it should take to certain issues. It entirely colours the perspectives of people outside the association towards the GAA because of the persistence of the rule, the ban rule on members of the police and the army. It's very, very difficult for an All-Ireland organisation, particularly when GAA clubs have been targeted, to actually have a rational debate in and around that. It takes the peace process, and actually takes, you know, GAA had an opportunity to do it in between the signing of the Good Friday Agreement and the referendum, and didn't take it. You know, it took some years after that before the ban on the police is actually removed. In terms of its approach to commemoration, I think there's a right way to do commemoration and there's a wrong way to do commemoration. I think what we saw in Cork early this year, I was less than enamoured by the approach they took. Slapping a mural onto a jersey and selling it for €70 to me didn't seem a dignified or appropriate.
For those listening, Mick Foley is shaking his head quite sorrowfully.
I couldn't agree more with Mark.
Yeah,
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah, no, I searched in vain when that announcement was being made for some wider program of reflection on it. I mean, two of the principals who were on the jersey had very little association, if any association, with the GAA at all. You put an event like Kilmichael on a jersey. I mean, there's a fierce debate going on around Kilmichael. It's still 20 people died, 3 IRA, 17 auxiliaries. This is, you know, you tread lightly when you move into this territory, and just putting something onto a jersey does not appropriate commemoration make. And I know some of the families were happy enough with it, but I think we need to kind of step back from that and take a more, and take a more serious approach to it. I think what the GAA have done with this centenary is much more impressive. It's much more impressive. You look at the program activities out there. It's very reflective. Very educational. There's a program of excellent lectures scheduled in the museum. And Rory, you know, I mentioned this to you yesterday. I think Mick's book has been critical in shaping the type of commemoration that we are going to see.
It is an amazing book. It reads like a thriller, you know, and you're kind of reading it and you're saying to yourself, this actually happened. What I would love to actually see, and again, look, I'm not the historian here, and I just want to throw it out there, just we'll say on a popular cultural level, I would love to see, I know there was a little snatch of Bloody Sunday in the Neil Jordan Michael Collins movie. It was only kind of a very short scene, but I would love to see what somebody with the filmmaking skills of a Neil Jordan could do if he actually just took the story of that day as a movie in its own right and try to make something cinematic of it, because the way it reads, it's just incredible. But to that point, I mean, you mentioned, Mick, that it was 3 years research on this. Like, can you give us a sense of how the difficulties that you might have faced there? Because obviously you don't have any eyewitnesses. You don't have, there's not too much audio records that you're dealing with. So by and large, you're probably working off National Paper of Records, the museums, history museums, National History Museums. Like 3 years is enough. That's a dissertation effectively. So can you just give us a sense of the work that would have gone into it?
Yeah, like we started in 2011. It was kind of in my head for 4 years before that. The reason I did another book in between. I just finished one book in 2007. I did another one in 2009, but it was kind of in the back of my head to do it. But what, to be honest with you, it was the size of the subject and all the things you mentioned there kind of held me back. I kind of felt I just didn't know what I would bring to it. But I kind of, at the same time, after the Ireland-England game in Croke Park in particular, you knew that there was an awful lot of gaps story and an awful lot of stuff that needed to be pulled together. So anyway, for better or worse, we started in 2011. I remember going to the National Archive, and there was a project done back in the 40s and 50s called the Bureau of Military History, where they went around and they interviewed, I don't know, Mark, it was 1,700 veterans, something like that, from across like the IRA, the Cumannamon, all sorts of organizations who would have been involved in that 1913 to 1923 period. So you had 1,700 of those. And I kind of went in with the notion of, right, I'm going to have to try and find any mention of Bloody Sunday in all of these. And I still have some of the slips, because you have to fill out the little forms to get the actual hard copy of it. I still have some of the slips somewhere there. I very vividly remember reading, I think it was Jack Scholdice's one. Yeah. And I had three or four or five more, and that was in a day. And I was like, there's 1,700 of these. So you had that, right? There was a brilliant, brilliant paper done in the early noughties by a Canadian historian, David Leeson. It's unbelievably good. It is absolutely amazing. After Bloody Sunday, there was two military inquiries. But the reports, the testimony, everything was basically sealed for 80 odd years. It came out, it was unsealed in the early noughties, and David took this material and basically did a kind of like Jim Garrison job on it, if you like. He just went through the minutiae of the evidence to create a picture of what happened, give a sense of who might have fired the first shot. It's forensically brilliant. So I had that. That was there. And like, anytime I ever talk about the book, I always want to give huge credit to David Leeson's work, because that was a massive thing he did. But then we also had access to I went to Kew Library in London. They had the original inquiry report, so you had that. They also had a little box. They had a little cardboard box, and you opened it up. There was the original map from Dublin Castle that they would have looked at to plan to go. They had the original order to go to Croke Park. They had a couple of letters that would have been exchanged between some families and the British Army afterwards and stuff like that. So there was little bits and pieces like that. So yeah, look, it was my thing always was, the story was always out there. You just had to throw the net out and try and pull in as much as you could. And then at the end of it all, try and apply some kind of Occam's razor to it, that the simplest explanation is probably what happened here. But it's funny you should say about the the kind of unbelievability about it. I'm involved in a documentary that's going to be on RT later on in the year, and we were up filming at the weekend, and we kind of were going around different parts of Croke Park doing my bit, kind of just filming things. And we were standing, we went right in behind the hill down to the railway wall where the Tipperary team would have been lined up after the game, and they were ready to be killed. They were essentially facing a firing squad. And I was telling the story, and this is at the end of a long, we were doing it all day, like doing this. But I was coming out, and I said to the guy the guys who were there, I said, like, this is unbelievable. Like, you know, I mean, I've, you know, looked into this thing for 9 years now, you could say. And to me, it's still, did this actually happen here?
It actually happened. That's the crazy thing about happened? It.
And the impact, the impact is extraordinary. I mean, like, it's not so much when you don't even have to go into the detail I went into, I don't think. Like, I remember telling a story. Sorry, I'm rambling along here.
No, I just said, your point is that I wonder what I could bring to it. Well, I might just tell you what I think you brought to it. Because you won't blow your own trumpet. I'll blow it for you. there is some brilliant scholarly work done on Bloody Sunday. I mean, Mick rightly acknowledged the work of David Leeson. I'd also give a special nod to an essay which Anne Dolan did in 2006, which is absolutely stunning. Most of these accounts, though, when they and there's another essay in a collection from Trinity College where Jane Leonard looks at, you know, the people who were killed on Bloody Sunday morning. So there's an awful lot of work that has been done. So what Mick is a real gift for storytelling. So he's not only has he just brought this together, and he's presented it in a way which it's reaching audience. It's a story that reaches audiences that none of that academic work reaches. Secondly, Mick went places where other people didn't go. I have read an awful lot in and around this in the primary source material as well. You look at newspapers, there's plenty of accounts on the funerals of the victims. The funerals of the victims of the morning, most of them were brought back to London, and they get a kind of a spectacular send off there. There's plenty of newspaper accounts of the funerals of the Croke Park victims. Not all of them are obviously from Dublin. Some of them are traveling home. So it actually unfolds not in the day, but actually in the weeks after Bloody Sunday itself, before some of those bodies are actually brought back. Everyone doesn't die on the day or in the same location. They die in hospital some days later. So it is drawn out for a couple of weeks afterwards. What Mick has done, though, is go beyond that. And he is telling us something about the victims, I think, beyond their funeral. So I was completely unaware that 8 of that 14, you know, were laid to rest in unmarked graves. You certainly wouldn't have known that from actually reading the accounts of the funerals. You'd have no sense of that whatsoever. So Mick's work, and you mentioned, I think you mentioned Croke Park approaching him about one of the, was it Jerome O'Leary in 2015? You know, what we've seen from the GA in the last number of years is something they've actually done very quietly. They've been working about kind of erecting headstones of these and restoring those graves and working with the families. And that would not have been possible without Mick's work. And that is something which is, it's not about wearing a martyr's crown. It's something which is very, very tangible. It'll leave a lasting legacy. So whatever about the events we do, that is something which has been actually done for families, which wouldn't have been possible. It's actually enabled the GAA to do something for families that wouldn't have been possible without Mick's work.
We'll finish up in a minute, gents. And we'll get Mick, I'll ask you to actually explain what the commemorations, what form they're taking just in a moment. But there's one line just in the GAA People's History, Mark, which I just wanted to get to before we finish. It said, for the GAA, it lent an entirely new aspect to the place of Croke Park in the story of the association. This was now more than merely a playing field. It was martyr ground, the place where people had been shot because they had attended a game football match. Is there any chance that without Bloody Sunday, another GA ground could have become Croke Park, could have become the focal point of the GA, because its primacy in the association is without question. And, you know, big games are played in Croke Park and that's it. And it is seen as headquarters. That's what it's called. Was there anywhere else that could have challenged it had it not been for Bloody Sunday? Did that give Croke Park a special status?
I don't think there's anywhere else that could have challenged it, because I think the GA would always have a headquarters in the capital city. That's what they, that's, they would have always had that. But there was that debate in the 1980s, particularly after, I remember the 1983 All-Ireland final where crowds came in. There was, I mean, there was a lot of issues in and around the stadium. So the big question for Croke Park in the mid to late 80s is, what do we do with this place? You know, do we redevelop here, or do we go to a brownfield site somewhere else in the city? You know, so, and let's remember, an awful lot of other sporting organizations, that's what they were doing. And an awful lot of other cities, they were, you know, places were selling up and they were moving out because they're effectively building stadiums for people to drive to rather than get the train to or walk to, you know. So the history hung heavy, I think, on that decision. It also hung heavy over decisions about opening up Croke Park. You know, it's interesting, like when, like the England game was not the first, you know, rugby match played in Croke Park. Ireland played France prior to that. And there didn't seem to be any of the kind of hullabaloo around that. Actually, I missed the first 20 minutes of that game. I was actually in Croke Park and I spent it sitting with a former GAA president who was Dermot Paddy McFlynn, who was president at the time of the hunger strikes. I was so wrapped in conversation with him. I missed the start of the rugby match. But we lost, right? Ireland lost that game. But when the England game, I mean, there was so much attention focused on it. You know, there was so much attention focused on it, simply because of that kind of troubled history. And similarly, you know, when the Queen visited in 2011, I think an awful lot of the pressure was relieved prior to her arrival in Croke Park, because she'd visited the Garden of Remembrance that morning and she'd bowed her head. And I think it had a kind of an emotional impact that most people didn't expect it to have. You have to remember, I mean, Obama traveled over here around the same time. That was an event which people were being encouraged to come onto the street, as opposed to the Queen, where people were being kept at bay from an awful lot of events. And yet it had a much bigger symbolic impact than the Obama visit. Yeah. So yeah, that history has hung heavy on how people have looked at it, how the GAA has looked at it, but
just the fact that the commemorations this year, I know it's just a pure coincidence that they're going to crisscross and intertwine with the running of the intercounty championships, but is there something appropriate almost about that in one sense? Or, you know, I know it's a bit of a fluke because of the global pandemic, etc., but the fact that the All-Ireland championships are going to run, like, I mean, you know, historically there have been Bloody Sunday commemorations before, and they've usually been in and around things like the international rules and these kind of gimmicky type things. The fact that this is actually going to coincide with the All-Ireland Senior Championships, is that a good thing?
I tell you what, I do know it makes it a logistical nightmare, in the sense of like trying to sort of figure out what's appropriate,
yeah,
in terms of, you know,
even what's appropriate from a TV point of view as well, Mick, like, you know, we'll be covering it, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah. Like, I mean, from everything, in the sense of like, look, okay, we're living in a lockdown world or a kind of semi-lockdown world, and it's very hard. I mean, I'll declare my interests here. Like, I mean, I'm on a GA history committee above for the last couple of years, and I'd be kind of, you know, be kind of in touch with Cian Murphy in particular. I mean, it's funny actually, you know the way in the GA, and you're all guys involved with clubs and stuff. You know the way when they say, you come up with an idea and say, you go to your club and say, I think we should do something like this, maybe. And they go, yeah, go do that. So like in terms of Bloody Sunday commemoration, an awful lot of credit has to go to Cian Murphy in particular, who works in the GAA press office, who's been driving this along. And I mean, you know, we have conversations with himself, and like, they've had so many plans and so many lovely ideas, and but it's you just don't know what can be possible on the day or on the night itself. So, and you know, having a championship and the Leinster football final is going to be on that night. So I suppose in one sense, it's kind of, it's hard to get your head around what will be possible. But I suppose, look, maybe there is a certain something all right that it will be, look, whatever commemoration there will be, it will be marked on a night that will already have significance.
Significance.
For a modern audience, you know what I mean? So people will be able to hook into it, you know?
Mick, we're presuming Dublin will be in the Leinster football final. I know that's a mad speculation, but is there any chance...
You'll have something to say about that in a few others.
Is there any chance we could get the Dubs to play the ceremonial game first? Get the actual Dublin team to play that and then have to go out and beat Wexford in the final?
I'll let you have that Zoom call with John Costello and Desi and see how you get on.
Tell us, what is, besides the match, which is a lovely idea, and it'll provide nice pictures and video evidence of it. But beyond that, obviously the GA, like maybe for more people like Mark and yourself, there's a series of talks going on. You're producing podcast. 8 podcasts. You've got a documentary coming. It's not just on the day, is it?
No, and I mean the whole, I suppose, focus of any kind of commemorative event has been to kind of remember the victims and to bring forward the story of the 14 victims, because I do genuinely feel that to really understand what happened at Croke Park on Bloody Sunday and the legacy going forward, you have to know the stories of the victims. You have to kind of be able to relate to those people. And I'm absolutely for sure confident that if people do kind of open themselves up to the story, they'll see stuff that they'll feel something for these people. So like in that context, like the GA started this week now, they have a series of films about each of the victims, like a little 90-second piece that all culminate in a 5-minute film that will be released. So I think they're going to be released every week going forward now for the next while. You have the Bloody Sunday, there's a Bloody Sunday kind of website hub, which is just, you know, it's got, you know, information on the victims. It explains the context of the day and various different other characters and people who would have been kind of connected to Bloody Sunday and in and around it. So that's going to be a nice, I mean, the thing about all this stuff is that it's stuff that has a longer shelf life than this year. It's stuff that's going to be there for people to access whenever the hell they want. So you have that. You mentioned, like, we're involved in a TV documentary. 2 pair films are making it for RTE, so that hopefully will be on closer to the anniversary in November. Yeah. The eight part podcast, the thinking behind that, from my side of things, I was doing it with my brother anyway. The idea behind that, I suppose, again, it's just this idea of trying to find as many outlets as we can for people to engage with the stories of victims. So the podcast, it's based heavily on the book. But it's a retelling of it. And in the last 6 years also, like, I've had so much contact with families and stuff like that, that there's a lot of new different stuff in there. There's an updated version of the book out. The Abbey Theatre are doing 14 one-person plays based on each of the victims. There's the Graves Project, and that's kind of ongoing, where it's nearly there now. And obviously then there'll be an element of sort of helping families if they wish to kind of just do a little work on the other graves, the existing graves that are there. And then we get to the commemoration ceremony, as you mentioned, on the 21st of November. And look, what can you say? Like, there's 3 or 4 plans there, depending on what we can do.
Yeah.
Like, presumably you're sleeping through December, Mick.
Well, funny you should say it, Mark. We're actually expecting our next kid on the 27th of December. So,
good timing.
I don't think I'll be sleeping. I might get that little 3-week window. But what I can say for sure, just on the in terms of the Saturday night, there will absolutely definitely be a commemoration. There will absolutely definitely be a moment for everybody to just to pause, probably before a Leinster football final, to pause and to remember these people and get a sense of what happened that day 100 years ago. And hopefully it'll do justice to the memory of the victims, because that, to me anyway, is the absolute most important thing. And it's the only thing that's on my mind. It's right front row center for me is remembering the victims in the right way and respecting the families as well as a result of that.
Well, I think that's a lovely sentiment upon which
lovely.
I would like to say thank you very much to Mark. and to Mick and to Rory. And
thanks, lads.
Listen, there's some Club GA on TV this weekend from Tyrone, and
double header,
and we'll have lots of sport GA included on RT on Saturday and Sunday Sport on RT Radio 1. Oh, and I'll just mention that we have the rugby podcast came back. It was released on Wednesday night. That's back. We also have a soccer podcast, which I tend not to mention, which I should mention more often. And obviously the RT website and NewsNow app for all your sports news. And listen, leave it at that. Again, thank you to Mark, Mick and to Rory, and we'll see you next week.
Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point, and there's the whistle. It's over!
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road, and that's not going to be taken away from us.
What I love in hurling, I love players that never give in.
He hits it! It's over the bar! Oh! Holy Moses!